This podcast is brought to you by MITEX, the Massachusetts Innovation and Technology Exchange, the region's premier association for thought leadership, technology trends, building business relationships, and professional training and development. For more information, go to www.mitx.org.
Get your Fresh BizCast here. I'm DC Dennison. This week, we've got food and business. First, Melanie Nayer tells us what's in store for Legal Seafoods and takes an olive oil tour of the North End with Chef Todd English. Then, Ross Kerber tells us how a Lowell company restored emergency communications to New Orleans. First up, Melanie Nayer. So, Melanie Nayer, you just spent a lot of time looking into what Legal Seafoods is doing. They seem to be in the midst of an entire rebranding. What kinds of things are we likely to see coming from them?
Sure. Well, Legal Seafoods, as you know, has been in business for over 50 years now, started with the Berkowitz family. And it started as its own fish market in Inman Square.
I remember that place.
It has since grown to the Legal Seafoods restaurant that you know now, which is what they consider their flagship restaurant. Aside from the Legal Seafoods flagship restaurant, they've opened up the Legal's Test Kitchen, which you know is at Logan Airport in the new Delta Terminal. Coming in first quarter of 2006 is what they're calling the Legal C Bar and Grill.
C as in the letter C.
C as in the letter C, which doesn't really stand for much right now, but is sort of a concoction of clams, cod, cocktails, crawfish, you know, any of the seafood C's.
And
calamari. And so what they're doing is taking the Test Kitchen and the C Bar and Grill and really switching those menus around to identify it more with the customer that's dining at those particular restaurants. So at the Legal Test Kitchen, it's going to be more catered for the traveler and the, you know, the busy Monday through Friday business class traveler who needs to get in and get out. But and then the Legal C Bar is really catered to more of the urban crowd of people who just want to go out on a Friday night after work, have a couple cocktails, maybe get a, you know, thing of calamari, some steamed mussels, that type of thing. But the food is going to be a little bit more eclectic than what you would see at an usual Legal's restaurant.
So it seems like they're kind of, I think of a Legal Seafoods restaurant as a big, bustling, horizontal place.
Like I said, the Legal's flagship restaurants are going to stay family friendly, you know, business conferences, that type of thing, where it is bustling and busy.
But it seems like, could it be that the trend in restaurants is towards smaller sort of pocket locations? I mean, both of these new concepts seem to be kind of small and almost boutique-y.
Yeah, and I think that's something that will be interesting to see as we go forward. One of the things that Roger Berkowitz was pointing out, and Rich Valente, who's the executive chef for Legal Seafoods, was saying during our interviews, is that each menu at the different locations is going to be tailored to that particular community in which the Test Kitchen or the C Bar is actually placed. So what you might find at a C Bar in downtown Boston, you might not find in Dedham. It really depends on the clientele.
Have they decided the first location for the C Bar?
They have not, as far as I know.
Oh, okay.
They haven't. They haven't told me.
But
we do know it'll be downtown Boston.
One of my reading your story, one thought that occurred to me was: could they be trying to distance themselves from seafood and get into, you know, more kind of meat dishes? When I look even at the photos that are on the front of the section, you know, one is sort of a vegetarian thing, and then there's also a turkey thing. Is that, do you think they could be trying to broaden out?
Well, I think that's the point of this. I think the point of the Test Kitchen and the C Bar is to broaden out and they're really
out
of seafood and into a more mainstream menu that includes beef and vegetarian and Asian dishes. But they're not going to completely do away with fish as the core of their menu.
Yeah. You know, I wonder if there's a certain, if you look at the national scene, I wonder if there's a certain percentage of diners who just have nothing to do with seafood. Like once you get away from, you know, the coasts and you're in Kansas and you're in Michigan, that people just assume that it's not fresh or they've never been exposed to it. So that maybe Legal Seafoods is looking out on the general landscape and saying, you know, there's 40% of diners that we're never going to get if we stay strictly seafood.
that's sort of the overall intent.
Yeah.
It's time to reach out to all levels of diners and not just the seafood eaters.
Yeah.
And that's where I think they're going with it. Are they going to go national? Are they going to try to, you know, are they going to take one restaurant and make it the Legal Seafoods meat market? I don't see that happen.
Right. What's their core regional spread? They're New England, they're New York,
New England. That's their main.
Mm-hmm. That's their core.
Their core is New England, and then they also have Maryland, Washington, D.C., and Florida.
Oh, okay. All right.
There are two locations down in Florida.
So, I think these test kitchens sound like a great idea.
Yes.
Hey, you also, while we're on the business of food, you also have a story in this very same Sunday issue on olive oil, and you took a tour with an olive oil connoisseur. Tell me what you learned.
I did. Todd English, who, as you know, is the executive owner and chef of Olives. And Todd and I went for a little walk through Boston's North End, stopped at a few Italian markets, and went olive oil shopping. Learned about the different regions that olive oils come from, how it's actually made, what foods to use with them.
Now, I'm assuming since you live in the North End, you already knew quite a bit about olive oil.
I didn't know as much as I thought.
Oh, huh.
What did you learn? It was very interesting. I think like any, average consumer, you buy your olive oil from the grocery store.
Right.
And do you really look at what's on the bottle?
No.
You grab your basic olive oil for $5.99 and you go home and you cook with it.
Right.
But when you actually go into these little Italian markets, shelves of Italian oils, plain green olive oil, plain black olive oil, mixed black and green olive oil, flavored olive oil with a black olive base. You know, there's a lot of different ways to do it, and each one is so distinct in flavor that that's how in Todd's case, what he cooks with, what he doesn't cook with, what he uses as dipping. One of the things that Todd did point out was that it's perfectly fine to go to a grocery store and pick up the olive oil that you like. It's really about taste. And he himself shops at Whole Foods and Trader Joe's when he just wants everyday olive oil.
Oh, interesting.
So you don't have to spend a lot of money for good taste.
Mm-hmm.
But the trick is to taste as many as you can, find what you like, and then use it.
One thing that surprised me is that the olive oil that he uses in his restaurants is from Greece.
Yes, he has his olive oil, and that's not the only olive oil he uses, but if you are at Olives, you will be treated to the olive oil from Greece.
Do the people in the North End know that he's using a olive oil from Greece?
Well, they do now.
I love the photo in the story. He looks so intent.
He is intent.
He's pouring the olive oil, and he looks like he's scrutinizing it.
Yeah, well, and he is.
Yeah.
And it's almost like tasting a fine wine.
Mm-hmm.
You pour the wine, you smell the wine, you inhale the wine, and then you drink the wine. And that's really how olive oil tasting is. And so as he would go through, they would pour the olive oil. He would look at it. He'd examine the color. He'd smell it. He'd make sure it's what he wanted. Take a sip. So it is a craft.
All right, great. Hey, thanks, Melanie.
Thanks, DC.
Ross Kerber, you've recently written an interesting story about a Massachusetts company that found themselves in the middle of the Katrina fallout in New Orleans. What can you tell us about it?
Sure. Thanks for reading, DC. This is a story about a company in Lowell called MACOM, which is a unit of Tyco International Limited. MACOM is one of the two largest providers of police radio dispatch systems in the country. The other one is Motorola, and so they compete to sell basically the radio equipment that you'll see police and firefighters using to communicate with the 911 dispatch centers. Now, in the case of New Orleans, what had happened is this is the company that had sold the city of New Orleans a $26 million system a couple of years back in the early 90s. They had a contract to build and service this thing. So they were the usual providers when when Hurricane Katrina struck the city on Monday the 29th. This was the company. One of the things that the hurricane did is it apparently knocked a generator offline on the roof of a building where the main antenna for the system was.
Wow. Did they have any kind of? Did the city have any kind of backup? What were the police and firemen doing it? At that point,
well, you know, the result of this tragically was that 90% of the system was knocked offline, and the only way that the emergency crews could communicate was through a lot of these fallback channels called mutual aid channels. There were only about two of them out of 24 original channels.
Hmm.
So this was a we'll be learning a lot more, I think, in the aftermath and the reviews of what went wrong. We'll be learning a lot about the difficulties that this caused. Everybody agrees that this is a near complete collapse.
Wow.
And caused a lot of law enforcement problems. From a technical side, what this meant for the company is a lot of fast work that the people I spoke with seemed pretty happy about, recovering and getting the system back online, which, no matter how high-tech these things get, really depends on having technicians at the scene. And mm-hmm. that's what a lot of this company's effort went back into doing very quickly.
Yeah, so they were trying to get past barricades, get to the tops of buildings. That must have been a real... it must have taken them quite a while to sort of get to their equipment.
Right. In fact, that's absolutely right. And in fact, one of the lessons learned is the difficulties that there were four technicians who worked at this company's office in Jefferson Parish next door to New Orleans. But when the area was ordered evacuated on Sunday the 28th, I think it was, all these technicians have families, and there was no provision for the families to be kept. So, they all said, I got to get out of here. And the company didn't feel it was their place to order anybody to stay when the city asked. So mm-hmm. nobody figured it would be as hard as it was to get back into the city. But in fact, it wasn't until I think it was Wednesday the 31st or even Thursday, September 1st, that they were able to, I forget the exact chronology, but it wasn't until then they were able to get somebody into the city and start climbing back up to the top of this 39-story office tower.
Wow.
Where the antenna was on the, they had the, what had happened was, as near as they can tell, they have their antenna with some key transmission equipment on top of this tower. It's called the Energy Center, and it's near the Superdome. Mm. And what had happened was, they think that some wind-driven debris or glass punctured the radiator of this generator. Now, this generator was only a backup generator, but a couple of other things had happened. The city's electrical power had gone down, and there was a gas line to this generator, and but the gas was turned off, so it was running on its own emergency fuel supply. They think the generator did in fact run, but because of the holes in this radiator, the coolant leaked out, and suddenly no generator. Even that wasn't something they were certain about until they could get a subcontractor tech up to the roof of this thing late in the week.
Wow. One thing that occurred to me reading your story was how many overlapping systems there are just like this. You mentioned that how many radio stations were out? I mean, just the standard AM-FM radios?
AM-FM, the FCC said there were only two out of 40-odd stations in the greater New Orleans area. Only two of them were able to stay on air.
Wow, that's really something. So so what's the lesson? I mean, is there anything that companies like MACOM can do, or is it just when something like this happens, you just have to get in there and start twisting wires
right.
together?
Right. I think what MACOM, well, I know what I wrote this morning in the story is that MACOM has been through a lot of this with hurricane, responding to the aftermath of hurricanes in Florida. So before this, as they saw the storm approaching, they made plans to activate what they called their emergency center, which is in a warehouse in or a manufacturing facility in Lynchburg, Virginia. And they had a lot of people calling and sort of technicians in place around the area that the hurricane struck. In fact, I centered my story about fixing New Orleans, but if you look at a map that shows all their locations,
oh yeah,
with the they have 20 odd other customers in the area. New Orleans was the hardest hit, but they were able to keep communications going in places like Baton Rouge and Jackson, Biloxi and Gulfport, and these are areas the hurricane came through as well.
Mm-hmm.
So what they've been doing since then is they had a lot of spare parts ready to go, technicians on call. It's a lot easier to do if your cell phones and pagers to these people are working, which
yeah.
it was in these other areas, but they still sort of knew ahead of time that they were going to be called on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, great. Hey, Ross, thanks a lot for that, Massachusetts angle on the New Orleans debacle.
Yeah, thanks for reading again, Deesa.
Thanks for listening, and check in next Wednesday for a brand new BizCast. Or better yet, subscribe and have BizCast automatically delivered to your computer and MP3 player.